yearning to play a few rounds of Gwent. That ought to set me straight.
It's Commander Sworn, episode 70. We've been doing this for 70 weeks and then some. Talking about the PTR and what we've seen and how it has felt to actually have a testing cycle, a week of testing, and how the community feels about the PTR as well. Lots to talk about between that and some discussion with Flake here on Commander's Horn. Thanks for tuning in, everybody.
We're having a few technical sound issues here.
Is that right? Unfortunately.
Yeah, I can't hear you through Skype. I didn't mean to. You kind of cut out by one midway through that. As soon as you said PTR, you kind of just went dead. So I was kind of looking for visual.
It's funny you said that, because when we did the podcast with Mogwai, he had the same problem. So something about me playing the intro and then speaking, something happens there with Skype. But you can hear me now?
Yeah, now we're all good.
We're all good. All right. So it's Commander's Horn. Welcome back to Commander's Horn. I'm just going to keep all this in. Who cares? A weekly Gwent podcast. I am your host, Dane McBeard, and I am joined today by Larry's best friend, I would say. Flake, it's good to see you, my friend. How you doing?
I'm doing very well. I don't like to... that's the thing. I'm more of a friend than I am a caretaker. People think that I own Larry and the Larrys. It's not. It's more of a relationship of equality and understanding and trust. There's no authoritative position in this entire Larry landscape.
This Larry land... Electric Larryland. And what is Larry, just in case you're tuning in for the podcast and you don't know what the Larry inside joke is?
Larry is the famed Arcspore, the Arcospore that, by now you'd think that he's actually more famous than I would ever claim to be. Larry sort of has penetrated the Gwent landscape far more than I ever dreamed of, which again is another Joe Snow movie reference.
Yeah.
No. Okay. So they don't all hit gold. I'm sorry.
For anybody who missed the intro of that of the podcast, the pre part of the podcast, that joke was just for you. So we had some pretty cool stuff go on this week, and one of those things was Joe Snow's shoe plays Sir Pumpkin and No Control all went to Philadelphia to the Nerd Street Gamers venue, where they did a live stream. All four of them. They had some beers. They played some Gwent. And I watched it. I imagine you maybe took in a little bit of it as well when you were able to. But it was a pretty cool thing. So we got to see the venue for Wild Hunt, and we got to kind of get a little hyped up for which would be a really good tournament. And that's coming up very, very soon on February 24th. That was a fun stream though, right, Flake? That was good.
That was a lot of fun. I think part of the best part was that the intro, the sort of the prelude to the actual on-location stream, was the IRL walk to the venue, where you can just see between the two of them who had the better, navigational skills between No Control and Joe Snow, which was fun because I now learned where every single Wahlburger is within like a 2-square-mile radius of that place, where they're all located, because I'm pretty sure they found them all. But it was a lot of fun, and you got to see the landscape of what the actual venue looks like, which is cool, and the stage of the casting area. The casting sort of location. So it was a nice sneak peek. It was definitely a lot of fun to watch.
Yeah. They look like they some friendships were definitely made there, I think, and perhaps some contempt. I'm not really sure.
Between bartender and patron, definitely.
Between bartender and patron, yeah. Every shot that I saw, it involved Pumpkin sleeping in some position, so on table, on chair. But anyway, it was a good stream. That was pretty cool, and we're really, both of us and everybody else involved, really excited to get down to Philly in about 2 weeks almost. It's just about 2 weeks away, so that's going to be it's going to be a moment in Gwent history, the meeting of the North American contingent. It's going to be awesome stuff. But we have other stuff to talk about, of course, because we did have a PTR phase that got started right before the last podcast, but we only really had a chance to read the notes. We didn't get to really dig in. Flake, you had some time to dig in, so we're going to talk about that. But first, I'd like to say that this episode of Commander's Horn is live, recorded on Twitch on my channel at twitch.tv/McBearded. You can find all episodes of Commander's Horn at commandershorn.com, and you can subscribe, listen to the podcast as it was meant to be listened to on iTunes, Stitcher, and other podcasting apps. Find us on YouTube as well. Send your emails to commandershornpodcast@gmail.com or tweet at us at Commander's Horn. No fake ad this week, unfortunately. I'm going to let you guys down on that one, but it's probably better than me trying to come up with one off the top of my head. I'm sure there's a little Shop of Horrors Arcaspore one that we could have done, but I can't quite get there.
Brought to you by Larry the Arcaspore, whose favorite song is Jump Around by House of Pain.
I like it. I like it.
We'll go with that.
But in reality, this episode is brought to you by our commandos. Hold on. I have it. Our commandos.
Commando!
Our patrons at patreon.com/commandershorn. Thanks for keeping the mics on and the podcast ad-free. So we're going to break for the little news interlude here. But we have lots of PTR stuff to talk about. Some stuff that Burge talked about on the Top Deck talk show. And a little bit more right after this. All right, top story, I'd say, is the PTR. The PTR was a pretty big deal because, unlike December, where the PTR was live for a day, quick sneeze dab, I saw it. Unlike the PTR in December, where the PTR was live for one day, which was a real talking point for a lot of people on Reddit, especially considering the patch did appear a little buggy and rushed, and people thought, well, maybe if you tested it for longer, which I don't think is necessarily, I don't think there's necessarily a correlation. I think that they were doing the PTR for the first time ever, and they wanted to see if it would even work. So knowing that it works, we got about 5 days, maybe even more than that, on the PTR. Flake, overall, how did you feel about the experience of having the PTR available for the general public? What did you see on there? And what would you maybe like to see in the future?
So my initial impression of it was, have you ever sort of, you're running a marathon, right? It's hot as all balls outside. You finally get to the point where you're at the end, or you're working out and it's a massive heat wave. You're just hot. You get that first amazing glass of water. That's what it felt like, because you were sort of in this environment that was just literally squeezing the life out of you, out of the current meta, and understandably so, a lot of people were tired of it, and the PTR was that first little sort of first sip of relief. Now, it's not going to be there, it's not perfect, it's fine, but it doesn't matter. That's not what it's there for. It was there sort of to give a taste, and obviously for testing purposes, that's what it was. It was a relief. Now, that aside, the fact that you got 5 full days in it or more, or you know, you got an extended amount of time, that was fantastic, because the first you get to see all the little kinks that everybody were, or not little, let's say, necessarily, but the big the arguments people were making about spies and dwarves strengthening to enormous power potentials and whatnot, that was all essentially rooted out right away. That was the first big like, oh, thank God. But then as you progress, new things become a little bit more, bubble to the top, where you're like, oh, now there's 8,000 bears I need to deal with, you know? So initially, fantastic, and it could only get better.
Yeah, so it was, I had a similar experience. My problem was that it didn't really hold my interest very much. Like, the thing is, most of the changes were numerical changes. There are a couple of fundamental changes, such as the Skellige Veterans going back to Soldier, which was which we talked about in the last podcast, is a triple buff. It is a buff because the Spear Maidens, the Spear Maidens, I think they're called now, can pull them out, and they are also pullable by Est, and they're also resable by Freya. So you get to play numerous Skellige Veterans, and Veterans were really strong. And I think that knowing that was all I needed to know, because, you know, the changed treason wasn't all that interesting. And the decks and the gameplay really kind of felt just like how it is now. It's just, I can't get my border or my rank on PTR. So I didn't play as much on PTR And I think if there was more changes, I mean, obviously there were no new cards this time around, but it wasn't really, it just didn't really hold my interest. So I only played for a day or two, and that was pretty much it. I'm excited that it was available, and I hope a lot of players had a chance to enjoy it. And I will be reading some tweets that I received today about that in a little bit. But yeah, so Skellige Veterans, the thing about it is that we are going to see a different version than what the PTR had for us. The PTR had the game in a certain state, Enforcers unchanged, Skellige Veterans being very, very strong with the Beastmasters, or Bearmasters, I believe they're called now. And that's just kind of there's like a solitary PTR meta outside of what we're going to get. So we don't really know what we're going to get. So what we are testing isn't ultimately what we're going to get. And I think that that's, I don't know, I'm not crazy about that, but I think that we were able to maybe identify some problems before they got too out of control, perhaps.
Right. And part of that, I think, is, well, you're right. Because there's kind of the meta is sort of split in two now. There's the actual real standard server meta, and then there's the PTR meta that people were sort of figuring out. And I wouldn't say that that's, you know, you're wasting your time trying to figure out a meta that's not even necessarily in a universe where everything's set, but people are trying to get ahead of the game in that part. And you said you only spent about one day or so in the PTR. I spent almost the majority of its uptime playing on that. I had reached wherever I wanted to be in terms of my MMR and my own tolerance of the meta and dwarves in the standard server, whereas I figured I needed a new sandbox to play in, so that's where we were. And sort of figuring that out was interesting. And you're right. I mean, the meta that's going to exist in there is not going to be, it's hard to figure it out because, like you said, it hasn't really been set in terms of what the card values are, even though some things got boosts in that and the buffing of you know, the Vortex and all this. But at the end of the day, you can kind of already see a little bit of what the landscape's going to look like, of what was touched, what wasn't touched, and Para Enforcers not getting at all any type of the, you know, the hurt from CDPR when it came to nerfs, which I don't think that's going to last. There's no way. I think that's the biggest outcry currently. I think that's a bigger outcry than the veteran, you know, outpour that came out, because that really only sort of splashed through for the first 2 or 3 days of the PTR. It was just a plague of veterans. And beyond that, then people started to figure out, hey, spies are still effing good. Like, they're still not touched. They're still, you know, it's like old reliable.
Yeah. But it's interesting because, first of all, I just want to shout out to the chat, Nordy Ott in the chat saying, as QA, I really don't know what this PTR is. I'm going to fix this, other than candy for the community. And I think it was. I think in a lot of cases, it was good to be involved, and it was good to see kind of the direction that the game's going to be taking. But with veterans in that state, with Nilfgaard in that state, it's not really indicative of what the meta is going to be like when we get to the new season, which is going to happen in a matter of day, parentheses S, depending on when you're listening to this, because it's coming very soon. But let's talk about Paul Berger on the Top Deck talk show. 5 days ago, he was on the show, 5 days ago, according to Reddit. And this is a Reddit thread by Matthias, who is very active in the Reddit. He listed all the stuff that that Powell said about what we can expect from the future that is not present on the PTR. First of all, veterans will be changed. How they will be changed, we don't know. But the way veterans are currently acting, getting Beastmasters up to like 8+ strength plus their Vortex, is a little crazy. So that was that's not good. So I'm glad that they are going to make sure that there's not some other points, like people call it point vomiting. I mean, I just call it an overtuned tempo deck generally. I think that there's always going to be tempo decks out there. But actually, I'm curious, Flake, where do you stand on what is known colloquially as a point vomiting deck? Do you think it's okay to have a deck that plays points like as far as like kind of like an aggro deck, sort of like Gwent's version of an aggro deck? Or do you think that there should be always combos that people rely on for points?
Well, see, I think the entire concept of a quote unquote point vomit deck, a lot of that comes from the fact that the points that you're generating are purely based on your side of the equator, so to speak. You're generating the points on your side in terms of bodies and strength. That has nothing to do with interacting with your opponent, because you can calculate, at the end of the day, it's all going to come down to point values, right? So a point vomit deck is just points that you're creating on your side to add to your total. It has nothing to do with removing points from your opponent's board. And that's what I at the end of the day, you can create a point vomit deck just by from a removal aspect. And there are cards that do that. Like, would you consider Ithlien with a double Tremors on a full board, a point, like a giant point vomit, when in reality, you're just taking points off the opponent's board? Obviously, point vomit decks are going to always exist. And the only thing is that they used to exist from a swarm perspective, where there was at least a little bit of setup that was involved, you know, trying to flood the board with you know, like Germain is one, would be one of like a Germain into a Horn kind of thing. And then that kind of snowballs into, you know, Triss Butterfly was one of the my favorite cards in terms of a swarm, you know, point, quote unquote, point vomit strategy or tactic. But now it doesn't even have to be that. Now it's just, I'm going to play a card and it's going to be worth 15 points. I'm going to play a card and it's going to be worth 15 points. It's not like, like, I don't want to always harp on or come back to Death Wish, but Death Wish has some amazing tempo plays too.
Yeah, you know, it does.
You put a Dao on the board as an engine for your Griffins and then into your Cyclops, whatever. Those are 17 to 19 point plays on their own. That's point vomit. But I have to first initiate by placing a Dao on the board and then saying on to you, and you're going to play 13 or 14 points, then I can make my 17, and then you're going to pick a 13 or 14. So you're always playing from behind. You know, there's no setup involved. I think that's what the point vomit aspect comes from. It's just that it's every play you make has no outside or secondary condition for you to generate more points. It's just on its own will be amazing. And how do I feel about it? I think that it's a little bit one-sided and it takes away from, I hate saying this, the spirit of what the game is supposed to be, which is, I don't want to say it's a chess match, but it's supposed to be a battle of wits. And if all you're doing is, I mean, if you can just cover up the side of one side of the board and just play on your own and just at the end of the day, just see how many points they have. Like, literally, that's a dwarf can potentially do that. They can just cover the board and look at the point total and then make their decisions based on that, because they know what every single card in their hand hand has in terms of point value, where other other factions might have, you know, like, for instance, Northern Realms. If you're playing Rams or Ballistas or whatnot, there's a little bit more. You can get an equally or greater amount of tempo swing or point swing, but there's obviously a lot more information you need from the other side of the board. Dwarves tend to not do that. They tend to be very self-reliant on and isolationist, so to speak.
I think I'm going to disagree on a couple of things. I think that Triss Butterfly was never point vomit. I think Triss Butterfly was definitely an engine that required setup. I also think that Griffin isn't. I think that the stipulation of having the Dao on the board makes it a combo, and I think that combos don't actually count for what people are maybe most upset about. The idea that you can just, you know, play Polly into a 12-point skirmisher and all that needs to be there is something on the board for your opponent. I think that's, and that's just, you don't even have to have that. The card's already good. So I think that as long as there is some interaction in some way, although skirmishers have the unfortunate situation of they do have interaction with your opponent's side of the board, but it's bad because that's what's making them so damn strong. So we're going to see that go away. We saw that on the PTR. We saw dwarves take a number of hits. Skirmishers now only boost. Yorveth Meditation is now limited to same rows. So people are going to have to play around it a little bit more, much like they play around Igni. And Ithlien isn't changed, but Tremors was changed to not spawn the six-strength golem. So stuff like that is changing for dwarves. And but it does seem like it's just kind of tweaks here and there. The style of dwarves isn't changing. And I had this conversation on my stream today where I'm okay with there being tempo decks out there. I just don't want them to be so overtuned that there's just no way to get past them regardless of how the game goes. So,
right. Well, there was a fundamental flaw to the actual dwarven faction in the sense that they were way overtuned. So maybe that's just the, you know, at the base of it all, that's what the problem is. It isn't the problem with the type of deck, the tempo deck itself, because those will always exist. Like you say, those are, it's a viable archetype, but it was just, you know, ramped up to fifth gear with dwarves right off the bat, whereas everybody was just playing catch up.
Yeah. I mean, it was pretty high. And I think Spies are going to be in an interesting position as well. However, one of the other things that was revealed by Powell on the talk show was that the Emperor Enforcers will be changed. Again, how they will be changed, we're not sure. we can make the assumption that they'd be going back to how they functioned previously, where they didn't, well, it's interesting. The way they worked was, if you played emissaries on the same turn that you played the enforcers, you did get retroactive pings. However, they changed it so no matter when you play the enforcer, you get the retroactive pings. My issue was always with the retroactive pings. I felt like if you play a spy before the enforcer shouldn't ping. Hopefully that they are, I don't want it to be in a situation where they made it worse so they can make it, they can revert it, and we can be happy with the state that they were in when they were already very strong in the first place. So, like, we forget how bad it was because we've seen how worse it could be. But we do know that enforcers are going to get changed. And more better patch notes are coming, which is great. More information and reasoning behind changes. I know the community is really going to be looking forward to this. And CD Projekt Red is always listening to the feedback. And they want to strengthen weaker cards. So this is really good as well. Avalok getting a Doom tag. Flake, how do you feel about Mill? And how do you feel about this? No longer will there be mill tech that can be applied into any deck or Nilfgaard specifically using Avalok and Renew. I mean, not being able to play Avalok twice really does limit mill options. I'm okay with it. I think my biggest problem was Avalok being picked up by Emir back in the day. When it was being able to be renewed, it wasn't so bad. I feel like mill was so much more disgusting when it was Magnes were the way they used to be, and it was just so much worse when you could demote Avalok and pick it up. It's not like that anymore. Now Avalok getting doomed means you're just never going to see Avalok more than once in a game.
So to that point, it was Avalok really the, I mean, Avalok was obviously one of the biggest issues to mill, but yeah. Avalok is it's not restricted to Nilfgaard, right? So there's going to be a lot of other other factions that might be not liking that change, but overall in the grand scheme of things, I think that the overwhelming majority of people just sort of quietly throw up in their mouths when they hear or cue into to mill. They know that it's beatable, but the process is just so bloody annoying. And I'm probably going to consider myself in the minority in this one. Even in the old mill, the Magni Division mill, which was god awful, if I can say, but I was playing a weather deck. Like a frost deck, and generally my strategy at that was you sort of, if you go into a long round and you hero pass, you should be okay, but it worked out now and then. But I thought that mill in the latest patch was in a spot where it was maybe one tweak away from not just being absolutely disgusting to play against and annoying, but remained still slightly powerful and viable somewhere in the, like, you know, like the low tier two level of play. I know that there's still some mill variants that are swimming around, and I've bumped into them, and, you know, I'll lose to them on occasion. It's frustrating because you're not necessarily, this is on PTR I'm saying, mm-hmm. But Avalok getting doomed, yeah, it solves a problem obviously because it just saves two cards in your hand, but then it opens up another gold for your opponents, so they might beat you in another way. But at the end of the day, if Mill's whole game plan is to, you know, suck cards out of your deck, then don't know what to tell you. Like it just keeps getting punished and punished and punished. And I don't think that it was as bad. I just think that people didn't necessarily know exactly how to beat it. And then it was became a frustrating aspect because it's tough to play and it's tough to beat. So if you don't find yourself on one of those two sides, then it was definitely something that you'd really want to see out of the game. And I guess this might be the nail in the coffin.
Well, I think one of the big things is mill in previous metas was people call it a binary deck. It's either you have the answer or you don't. So you win or you lose. And that's just how it is. It's going to be able to execute a strategy and beat you or not. So I think that that's the biggest problem with decks right now. I feel like consume is kind of walking that line right now, if not really walking the line. I think in a lot of cases, if you don't have the answer to consume and if you can't deplete the resources in round two is really more what it's like, you lose. Like you just can't really, you can't get a leg up on that deck. It's just too strong and too powerful. So that's why you see consume targeted in Gwent Open when JJ did that and won because of his awesome tech. And why consume is concerning when we don't really necessarily see any changes to consume. So We'll see how that goes. And I also think that Avalok was maybe limiting, like if you have a card that draws you two cards that you can renew, so it draws you four cards, it makes it really hard for you to add, for you being CDPR, to add cards to the game that draw cards for your opponent, like Stregobor was added, so, and Shylard was added as well. So with those cards added, Mill gets stronger, even though they're trying to take tools away from Mill. Mill's going to find a way, and there's some streamers that will always try to make Mill work. And I think Crokies is a strong fan of Mill as well. So if there's a way to make it work, he'll do it, and he'll popularize it, and people will play it. Other people will also figure it out as well. So Mill getting just buried a little bit more, I think a lot of people are happy about it. I have mixed feelings because I don't find it to be so bad, but it is so lame when you lose to it. It feels so bad. So moving on, Nithril is going to be changed further because it doesn't seem like they really made that card that much better with its current change. It's going to be something like 6 strength, deal 6 damage, plus 1 for Wild Hunt units in your hand. I think it'd be better if it was in your deck, personally. It kind of plays a role similar to Yorveth right now, where you want to use it as early game removal and get the benefit from that. But I don't know, it's okay. I mean, it's potentially better than it currently is, and definitely better than how it is on the PTR. And then there's Ithlin and the change to Tremors. Tremors losing the 6 strength golem that spawns when you destroy a unit at 1 strength. Flake, I don't know how far back your experience with Gwent goes. I can't remember, really. But were you ever playing in a meta where Tremors affected your opponent's side of the board only and not your side of the board?
Yeah. I was here all the way since this. So I was here since closed beta. I've seen a lot of different renditions of Tremors. I've used it on occasion. And to be completely honest with you, that one brief little sort of speck on the radar when it used to spawn an Earth Elemental rather than just like a Golem, that to me was fantastic because it was just another. I used to play a Cockatrice, Celeno Harpy, and Tremors deck, and those things would grow out of freaking control, and it was my favorite deck for a little brief period of time. And but it's funny because that seems like Tremors is just getting constantly put through the washer over and over and over again, when maybe that's not the issue. Like, that's not what the problem card is. It could be not, but yeah, I remember when it would actually just wipe the entire board with one damage. That was a while ago, though.
Yeah, it was a really long time ago, and Tremors has seen a lot of changes. It's interesting because Tremors makes me think about what the game could be if they reintroduced effects that were considered overpowered early on, but now with the kind of the power level of bronzes going up, is it so bad? Because when Tremors was deal 1 damage to everything on your opponent's side of the board and deal no damage to your side of the board, it was auto-include and it was oppressive, and people didn't like that. So they changed it to, there was a bunch of different situations where Tremors did 2 damage to your opponent's side of the board and 1 damage to your side of the board, and then 1 damage to everything on the board, and then a capped amount of damage to your opponent's side of the board. And then they added the golem that spawns when it kills, and now that part is gone. So there are always Tremors is always, or was it 1.2 damage to everything on your opponent's side of the board? I think people who go way, way back, may remember exactly what original iteration from October 25th, 2016, when it first came out. But it was all over the place. That card was super, super strong. You just play a long round, and then you just Tremors, and you win. So it was pretty crazy. So thinking about cards like that and thinking about how cards of old could be considered these days, and I'm not really sure if I can think of anything off the top of my head, but I'm sure something will come to me.
The old Celeno Harpy wasn't it a 7 spawning 2 eggs, which then in turn spawned 2 threes while boosting and consuming. Imagine that card in today's, you know, is it really all that much more powerful? It could be, maybe. I mean, in today's consume meta, is there even space for that card in that deck? But imagine that with a Forktail.
I mean, the fact that Celeno Harpies was spawning the threes was more of the problem with the carryover that the eggs could give you.
Oh, now, and carry, I didn't even think of carryover.
Yeah, the egg carryover was destroyed. So by destroying the egg carryover, does the school of thought is, do the harpies need to be 1 anymore? Could they go back up to 3? Is that too strong? Does it matter? It's like little things like that, because changing cards based on one mechanic and then that mechanic going away and keeping the card in what is arguably a nerfed state, is that necessary? Could they go back? Could the cards all be reevaluated? I mean, giving Gwent another full reevaluation of all the cards when they clearly just did that, and they do that a lot, is, I mean, it's not unexpected. Most of these patches that come in, I feel like I need to unlearn everything. So It's I'm just
you touched
I'm just
on a good point there.
Yeah.
I was gonna say, because you were mentioning it, how there's been an obvious power creep, and things have sort of been adjusted, and you're mentioning how things back in the day used to seem overpowered, but today they might seem just, you know, like a good card, not necessarily an overpowered card. But there's a lot of things that haven't been touched, and there's a lot of things that have remained the same for, you know, since day one, more or less. And then Thunder became a 9 instead of a 7 and whatnot. Like, at some point, doesn't it seem like an entire reevaluation of everything? Because it seems like every time that there's an adjustment made to either throttle something back or throttle something up, that there's always going to be a handful of cards that are just left stagnant, which then in turn, by comparison, makes them worse. Mm-hmm. So you can't just touch half of it or a large portion and leave some on the side and just hope that no one notices because no one plays it. Anyways, that's just my opinion on that.
Yeah, I mean, it's I guess we'll see kind of how things will ultimately be changed in the future, because I know that they did talk about changing weaker cards. So we'll see if any of that kind of gets applied there, because there are some cards that feel like they maybe are left behind or left behind in a state that's too weak in a new world kind of thing. So I feel like Drowners could get a boost personally, but I don't know. Maybe I'm crazy about that.
I used to play Drowners in a lot of my decks, and I kind of got a little bit upset when they took away the fact that you can't move your own units. I think that might be the boost that they need.
Yeah. I also miss that a lot. There are a lot of situations where I was playing Aridin, Moonlight, Nova, where just moving my own unit would have saved the game for me.
Right.
So another big change, and very near and dear to our hearts here on Commander's Horn, is the nerf to Commander's Horn. So this one is too bad. Commander's Horn currently buffs 5 units by 4, 20-point play. It'll now buff 5 units by 3 to a 15-point play. Nerfing a card by 5 points is pretty nuts. So on the talk show, Berge says that if Commander's Horn is dead after this change, they might change it somehow, some way. There's also a suggested change of boosting 6 units by 3 to an 18-point boost, which seems reasonable. Doesn't seem too difficult to get 6 units on the row. It also makes you more susceptible to row punishment because you're putting 6 units on a row. So I think that's okay. There should be punishment for row stacking if there's going to be benefits to row stacking. But Commander's Horn, it's too bad. I mean, it's been such an iconic card, and I think the big problem is that there are a lot of decks and abilities that can allow you to play it twice. And there's John Atalis that comes out with a body, or two bodies with Roach. And I think they might think that that's just a little too strong. But meanwhile, Iris is unchanged. I don't know. Do you have any thoughts on Commander's Horn and the strength level of Silvers, maybe, when you kind of look at this level of nerfing?
Well, of course I have opinions on Commander's Horn, McBee. Come on. That one hits close to home. So part of the issue, I think, with Commander's Horn nowadays is because it's more accessible as a card for people to get it. You no longer have to necessarily draw into it. It's just often just there. You know, a Royal Decree into a Natalis into Commander's Horn late game. So you don't have one out. You have three in order to get it, so to speak. And every single out that you have down the chain makes that entire sequence much more powerful. So not only do you have it more often, but you have it in more powerful ways. So I can see how it got a little bit of the nerf hammer on it. But if you're looking at it from a power perspective, yes, 20 points. And it's 20 points for 5 units in a row. And that's fantastic. But what does that do? It makes your row more vulnerable to things like Igni. So you have to play around it. And I don't think that they should be punishing cards that require a little bit of foresight in terms of how it's played or set up, because if you're buffing if 3 of those 5 units suddenly happen to be the same power level and Igni hits the board or a Scorch or something down those lines, it's a card that requires that has a huge power swing but requires a little bit of, you know, protection and whatnot to make sure that you're playing it safely. But at the same time, if they're going to put it into a 6x3 to an 18-point silver, obviously you're going to play it. But I don't think – or you're going to play a card that's worth 18 points. But are you really going to play it because you need 6 in a row? It's like Rockslide. Rockslide's a 20-point potential silver card.
Yeah,
Everybody would be playing a 20-point silver, like, hands down, no problem. But you're rarely getting that value. So is putting Commander Sworn into a 6x3 really a buff, or is it going to fall into rock slide territory that's like, wow, that's amazing, but it's never going to happen?
Well, rock slide also is from it being point removal, and there's a lot of ones in the game, so they don't even, it doesn't even get full.
We have a little, apparently there's a, so McBee just went full Vader on me. Apparently there's a little bit of a mic issue that you might be going, you might need a little bit of a kind of just little reset on that. So,
testing.
So, and looks like he's back in business. He's gone from full Vader mode. He's removed the mask. He has come back to the light side.
Is it okay now? Is it better?
Oh, we are much better. You were legitimately just, you were about to throw the Emperor into the reactor core.
Did you hear it too, though?
I did, yes. Oh, I did. You... And I was trying to go in, and there was just a wall of text, but we're good.
Yeah, we the chat's been awesome, by the way. Shout out to everybody in the chat. It was definitely moving a little bit faster than normal. That's a young Vader. That was wild. Okay, so I don't even know if you guys even heard what I said. I'm just reading the, your mic is too loud. Whoa. Okay, so what I was saying about Rock Slide is that Rock Slide has the, it's point removal. What is that? All right. It's point removal. So because there's ones on the board that it may not ever reach its maximum potential because it is RNG, you don't know what it's going to hit. There's ones on the board, so it's probably always going to end up being a 20 point card. Whereas Commander Sworn does need a setup that's very relatively easy to achieve, especially considering there's so many cards that pull other cards, especially when you are Squirtle and especially when you're Northern Realms. And really, I think every faction has that now. So sorry about the mic troubles, guys. And I think I'm concerned about Iris is something that I said as well, but you may have just lost it. So hopefully that's funny. If it doesn't completely like blow your ears out in the podcast, I'll keep it in, or maybe I'll edit it so it's, you can at least hear what happened here. So, hey, mic problems, live podcast. Here you go. Moving right along though. So Yorveth Meditation, this card is, the fact that it's being changed now to be row based and you can play around it like you can play around Igni. That's overall a good thing because it was just a little bit too strong. It really, that combined with what Ithlin was able to do in a short round or a long round was just too many tools for Squirtle. So they lose a little bit in Ithlin. They lose a little bit in Yorveth Meditation. They lose a little bit in Pauly because Dwarven Skirmishers aren't going to strengthen anymore and Mahakam Guards have a low base strength again. And that's it though. Barclay's going to stay the same. Pauly's going to stay the same. Do you think it's going to be enough, Flake, or do you think that people are still going to be playing Dwarves?
I think they'll still be playing Dwarves. I think that the actual fundamental aspect of the deck being great in terms of just, like you said, tempo decks. It's a tempo deck that doesn't necessarily gain momentum to crush you in small amounts of cards later on. The Yorveth Meditation change, I think, is good. It can now be played around. I think that Yorveth Meditation is now going to not necessarily be a card that you have to wait till the end to wait for bomb cards to come out for you to get max value. It might be more of a card of opportunity that you play for a tempo swing or a removal option. So waiting for your opponent to make a mistake and just sort of, you know, remove a resilient unit or remove an engine unit or whatnot. It's no longer going to be a matter of busting out the TI-83 plus and figuring out just exactly what is the statistical best two dudes to, you know, slap each other around and then come out on top kind of thing. I like the change because it, like you said, it could be a new Igni play around. Obviously it's not as easy to play around because you'll always have more or less units on the rows, but it's no longer a late game card because if you're going into the last round three cards and you're with Meditations in your hand, it might not find a target.
Yeah, it's like Igni in that you may just take the value when you can get it kind of situation.
No.
So
right,
and it's
exactly.
But it's also, it works, you know, you can still line it up with spies. Like 8 and 13 is a really popular combo. 13 and 21 is also a really popular combo as far as like maximizing your value. I think it's a 22 point play when you play 8 into 13. So if you, and since spies are 13, you can set that up so you can play your 13 point spy on a row with an 8 and then you can maybe take the round that way. So I think that it's not going to be totally dead, but it's much, much worse than it currently is, but it's arguably too good. Monster Nest lost its boost completely, but is going to get some boost back. I like this. I thought that taking all 3 points off of the boost was a little heavy-handed. So that's a big one. I mean, I think it's there's not a lot to say about that. It's just it's clearly a play rate situation with Monster Nest.
It's everywhere. It's a really great tool card, but it's also a great late game option as well. Depending on, I love playing the card in Deathwish because it spawns a Deathwish unit, it spawns a Deathwish trigger, and it spawns a late game bomb card with a ghoul, which in the PTR was you don't even have to play Imperial Manticore anymore because you're always gonna probably spot a spy in your own graveyard for you to eat. So the fact that it lost its boost was definitely a kick in the pants. It was not enough of a nerf for me to rethink that silver slot in my deck. However, it did kind of hurt a little bit down the road because that extra 3 points doesn't seem like much, but the fact that it was all gone left a sour taste in my mouth. I'm glad that it's getting a little bit more of that spice back.
Yeah, we're both Monsters fans, unapologetically, so... I mean,
yeah, only one of us has a Monsters a little logo next to us. It's fine.
Yeah.
To sit under the banner of sadness. It's okay.
That's just how the setup is.
It's all good.
Red and purple, they go together, right? Sure. So there wasn't much else said. So the thing is, a lot was hinted upon, and this was a week ago on Thursday when this stuff was said. A lot of stuff can be looked at. Data can be collected. The PTR is now closed. It closed yesterday. So, I mean, I don't think it was active at any point today. So that means that the finalized changes are coming to the patch. The patch will be dropping, I do believe. Today's the 6th. I think the season ends on the 7th. I should know this definitively.
I believe so, yes. And then the 8th should be the patch.
And then the 8th is the patch, something like that. So it's coming within a day or two. So the patch is being finalized, and we're going to get it soon. And that's exciting because we're going to have a whole new world of Gwent to play. We're going to get to rank up again. And it's been an interesting meta. Not a lot of Grandmasters. I'd say like hundreds and hundreds of people not actually Grandmaster. It's interesting. How does this affect Pro Ladder? The Pro Ladder season isn't over, just the rank season. So I don't think it changes the Pro Ladder at all. I don't think people are let into the Pro Ladder unless there are new entrants. You start late. I can't imagine why you'd want to start late unless you are really, really good at not losing. And you can just soar to the top and do it in a short amount of time. So I don't think anybody's going to be added in, but I'm still not 100% sure, and I don't know if anybody else is 100% sure about how it's working, where if you get a top rank in the mid-season season between a pro ladders, like pro ladder doesn't end until the end of March, end of February. So do the people who did really well in this season, do they get anything at all? Do they get consideration for pro ladder later? And are they part of a group that is going to be also established at the end of February? And that group is like the graduating class for the pro ladder? Or does it mean nothing at all? Is it just for ranks and borders and stuff like that? So I'm not really sure if they have, suggested that, but there are no new cards. We know that much. We know there's only balance tweaks, and we know that balance tweaks will only be happening at the end of seasons. And yeah, and it's coming soon. And the next time we talk on the podcast, it'll be about the new patch and what we're playing. Are you planning on playing anything different? I mean, the changes aren't that widespread. I guess this is just one last discussion here, is the changes aren't so extreme that it is, I would say this doesn't enter the territory of breathing new life into the game for me personally.
Well, breathing new life can mean not necessarily new cards, but it can mean just the fact that it opens up other factions that becoming maybe not viable, but competitive, because you right now you hit that. There's always that kind of echelon. Last season, it was like once you hit rank 20, then the amount of decks that people are playing really hones down into narrows them out into like two or three different archetypes that you'll probably see 90% of the time, because they're obviously the most powerful and most powerful amongst each other, you know, in terms of being competitive. That to me, this current season was at 4K. I hit 4K about 80 games in, maybe a little bit less, probably about like 75 to 80 games in. I got to 4K a while ago, and then I just stopped because the fun was kind of sucked out real soon once a positive win rate turned into facing dwarves and spies over and over again. So the fact that those might not necessarily be the insta pick of competitive in the later stages of ladder, that might breathe new life in itself because it'll keep a wider variety. It'll kind of just broaden its arms and welcome a few more decks into the higher ranks. So from a perspective of changing the archetypes and the types of decks you're seeing, it might not be a huge change. but you'll see more of them coming in versus that sort of that bottleneck that happens at a particular point in the ladder where you kind of seeing the same thing over and over again.
I want to address something that's been said in the chat here. Mercavirus just said, because we're talking about maybe what's going to be really, really strong in the new meta. Nilfgaard Spies is a looming threat for the top dog spot once again. Mercavirus is saying, at least Nilfgaard Spies isn't a brainless deck, perhaps suggesting that Dwarves is a brainless deck. And I have had this discussion on not just my stream today, but also yesterday's stream, in that what really matter, like how does it matter how hard a deck is to play? When you look at a deck like Dwarves, you look at a deck like Spies or even Mill or anything like that, if there is a guide and you have time, the difficulty and the skill ceiling for the deck probably won't matter, because especially if it's a super popular deck and a lot of people are playing it, the more people are playing it, the more likely you are going to learn how to play it. You have the ability to learn it, and even though something might be daunting to pick up, if you play it enough times, you can become very, very good at that deck. So does it really matter how hard a deck is to play, or does it ultimately only matter how strong it is?
Let's put it this way. So you're on the ladder and you face, you get queued into an Arrakis Queen. You know what the ideal turn set will be. It'll be Necker. It'll be Necker Warrior. It'll be Vran into the Necker Warrior. It'll be Slizzard into the Necker back to revive. There's obviously an optimal set of plays for every single deck, the ideal way to do it. And the simpler the deck construction is, where the synergies are super powerful, the easier and quote-unquote brainless it is to play. But every deck is going to eventually have to make decisions. So they're not necessarily brainless. What I think that people say when they say brainless is that it's not necessarily interactive, and that you have a multitude of options to put you ahead of your opponent. So something like Dwarves being brainless, I wouldn't say it's completely brainless, because you do have to, like any other deck, you have to balance and manage your resources and think about late game opportunities. They just had more options available that were interchangeable given the scenario. Something like Spies, they have to figure out, okay, am I going to have a long round one and a mid, like, and a insta pass, like a dry pass round two, and go into a 4 or 5 card round three? Am I going to go for a 6 card round one? So maybe I don't want to devote my 2 Impera Enforcers because those are important. I can see where some decks require a lot more decision making, a lot more foresight, and that takes practice, obviously, not just on knowing how your own deck functions, but on how your opponent's deck functions. But Dwarves, it seems like the brainless tag that they acquired was because out of their 10 cards that they have, in any given time, 5 or 6 of them will put them in a beneficial standpoint in regards to their opponent. Their resources are a lot more interchangeable and I guess invaluable from a perspective of, sometimes you just hang on to a card because, like, I absolutely need this for round three. There's no question about it. Whereas, you know, Dwarves are like, well, I can toss this out or this out or this out. At the end of the day, it's all worth the same. It's all worth more or less the same points. So I'm going to get as close to one, or I'm going to get as close to just 1 point ahead of my opponent, so that the more points I can invest for later.
Yeah, it sucks when you can't really tap your opponent out of important resources when all of their cards are so strong. And I think that that's where the root of it comes from. If all of your cards are strong, then it doesn't matter. Maybe the order doesn't matter. You can maybe misplay a little bit and still just outpoint your opponent in a short round and a long round. You never get behind. You win the coin flip, and it's really tough for your opponent to do anything. You can take ties all the time if it ever comes up, and you can just beat them because your cards are stronger than theirs. And I think that's where the root of it comes from. That's where it's, you know, it takes less skill to play it because all your cards are just stronger. So you're just playing with a deck that's better. And I think some people maybe just kind of equated it, kind of it inhabits the same neighborhood of cheating to some people, where it's like, well, you're just playing with better cards than I am, and that's not fair. So I don't think that – I think that the discussion about if a deck is easy to play, or as the chat has been saying fairly savagely, that idiots can play it and stuff like that, I think it's really more about the deck is just overtuned. I don't think it's really – it's mostly exaggerated, I think. But it's not completely untrue. I mean, if cards are strong and the decks are strong and pro players are playing it and you're seeing how they can play it and you can tune into streams and you can see how they dominate with it and you can mimic what they're doing, it's going to be a problem. It's going to be widespread. So I think that the game will always have a deck like that. I've never heard anybody say in a game, except for maybe, I don't even know if this is even true, but maybe like Handlock and Hearthstone at one point. I don't know if anybody's ever said in a game like, oh man, that deck is so strong, but it's so hard to play. And like, usually you want to attack the person playing it. You want to be like, oh, this idiot is playing this. Anybody could play this deck. You know, it's just like, I feel like that there's no like, you don't respect somebody playing the strongest deck in the game because they're geniuses. Like, it doesn't ever come out like that. At least I've never seen that personally.
But you know, part of it could be that you could be a really, really good player and playing a really powerful deck. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that necessarily.
Yeah.
I mean, and just looking at the chat, Oroshiyushi, hopefully I'm pronouncing that correctly, just pulling out Spies Interrupted, that is a brainless move. But you know what? Sometimes, I mean, and I'm not a Nilfgaard player, but I've seen some Nilfgaard plays, and sometimes if you have one or two Imperium Forces on the board and you have the option of pulling the third, a lot of the times you might not pull the third one. It might not be in your best interest to invest three engine cards. So is that a decision that you particularly make, where you're tossing out three engine cards and hoping for the best in the late rounds? I mean, a lot of the time, if I know I'm going to fall behind seeing three Imperium Forces on the board and a lot of game left, you know, like, if I have six or seven cards left in the round, I might just pass and say, all right, well, there goes a lot of your, you know, of your damage that you can do nonetheless. So there's aspects of quote unquote brainlessness. And part of it is the fact that if they want to pull all three out, then they'll pull all three out. That's the way it goes.
So, I mean, it's true. I think that it's probably, I do think it's fairly exaggerated. I think that, you know, obviously brainless is an exaggeration generally, because we all have brains that work. Like, it's just, you know, it's just trying to insult the people that play those decks. And on stream, I do it. I'm guilty of it as well. I yell at people who play with stuff that's gonna get nerfed, because shame on you.
I heard all that today.
Yeah, if you're gonna play something that's getting nerfed, I have every right to insult you mercilessly, because it's not exploitative. I don't know if I would say that, but I would say that you know what you're doing. So, you know, you're playing the stuff that's been identified as too strong. So take that and, you know, cry yourself to sleep is basically what I've been saying. So there's that. And I'm really excited to see what the new patch has in store for the meta. I hope that it balances. I hope that there is a nice distribution of stuff. I hope nothing reigns supreme. I hope nothing was missed. I hope no last minute changes were like, you know, maybe bad decisions. So we'll have to see. Flake, I want to go a little off script here, and I actually want to talk to you a little bit about Deathwish, because I've been playing a lot of Deathwish right now, and I think that Deathwish might actually be in a really, really good state. So I feel like you're the best person to talk to about Deathwish. So we're going to talk about this in our strategy section right after this.
Maybe not today and not tomorrow, but someday someone will find a way to take you down.
Topic number two on the podcast, Death Wish monsters. So the last couple of days, today I was playing full test, but on Monday and on Thursday and a little bit on the weekend, I played a little Dagon Death Wish. And I don't think Dagon needs to be the leader, but it was a list that actually, it was just a simple tweet from Petrify, who had augmented a list by Trance Energy 2. He was playing a Death Wish Nova list. The marquee part of the list was the Nova. He was kind of hoping that people would pick up the list so people could understand how strong Nova is. And Nova is very good in this list, but I'll go through the list with you. And I know that you've been playing Death Wish for a really long time, but I'll go through the list that I'm currently running. And but generally, though, there's a lot of really cool stuff. And we touched upon it a little bit earlier, talking about how Dao and Griffin is able to work. There's a lot of big tempo plays. But Deathwish, generally, just as an overview, first of all, I'd like to talk to you about your history with playing Deathwish, why Deathwish appeals to you, and why do you feel like it's been kind of a much maligned support-needing archetype for monsters for so long.
So Deathwish back in the day, when it wasn't getting, before Arcuspore, before Lyra the Arcuspore came and just absolutely just enchanted me with its amazingness, there were Earth Elementals and there were you know, harpy eggs and stuff along those lines and whatnot. And it was good. And I liked it I didn't play it exclusively, but that as soon as Larry came out, that's when everything changed. That's when I actually just kind of dug in and said that this thing has potential, because frankly, a Larry is kind of like almost like an extra weather piece onto the board. So damage over time is something that I was always into, and I played a lot of fog before I played Deathwish, so I was really into weather style decks where there's damage over time and there was attrition involved and whatnot. I thought that it obviously was not first rate, and by no means, by no stretch of the imagination, did I ever try to sell the deck or the archetype as being something that was super powerful, that people were sleeping on, that it was, you know, you guys have no idea what you're missing. I thought that it was close. And I wanted to prove that. I wanted to prove that a good player can take any style deck as gimmicky, even though it's not a true gimmick. It's not like playing, you know, like a just Cambi or something like that. But I thought that it was enough of a niche that people would ignore it, but it had potential, and it was just almost quite not quite there where I can take Larry and the boys and just go straight for it and see how far I can go. And I did that. And I did it before Nova. I did it in the previous patch. I took a Deathwish deck to 4,400 MMR. 4,414 was my final MMR plateau that I got with Deathwish. Yeah. And I was stupidly proud of that. And I thought that just in that, mind you, I played a crap ton of games. I lost a lot of games. And I was at 4,300 to 4,400 for weeks. And you kind of eventually figure it out. You're not going to beat the top tier stuff. And it's fine. And it's cool. This season, I had, once I hit rank 20 with it, not rank 20, sorry, rank 19, 4K, once I hit rank 4K with probably about a 68 to 70% win rate, and then that was the plateau there where it was sort of losing steam. But I think that it's missing one piece from not just being a viable and good deck. I think it's missing one piece to being a tremendous deck. And I don't know what that piece is, and I'm waiting for it. But I know that there's a Sheetrol came close. I think Sheetrol is a fantastic card for a silver swing. But I think that the card it's missing is more locked in terms of a leader card than it is in. And I know that's a big ask, obviously, to create a leader that'll sort of work and tool with Deathwish.
That's an interesting idea. I like that, actually.
But I think that's exactly what it's missing. And I think that, and you'd think that it would be Arrakis Queen because you can consume things, but a good Deathwish deck, my Deathwish Nova deck that I had exceptional results with this particular season, played, the first version of it played four Deathwish cards, two Daos and two Larrys, and that was it. And you think that that's not a lot, because given the fact that it all surrounds that. But with Slizzards, they were there with Daos sitting on the board to unsuspecting people at 6 points, and they would never touch it. Because in their minds, destroying it would be counterproductive. But in this case, it sat there as an engine for your Griffins and your Cyclopses and whatnot, and you can catch a lot of people off guard. The addition of Nova, as oppressively, you know, dividing as that card can be in terms of people who like it or people who don't, that was a good end game, because Deathwish rarely had an end game. It was a good keep up with your opponent deck, but it was never had the gold finisher. And I used to rely on Succubus to sort of finish games off, and it never worked that way. At the moment now, with Nova, I know people might hate that card in general because it's so prominent as a finisher, but it's there for a reason, for deck archetypes that might not have that late game option or that quick catch-up one card option.
For sure. I'm going to show the deck on the screen. I'm also going to talk about the deck as well. So the deck... No, I'm not. No, I'm not. I'm not going to do that. That's weird. I'll have to do it this way. So I'm on the screen, so I'm going to remove myself from the screen. But really, it's... there we go. That's a little bit easier. So the deck that I've been playing right now, it's running Caretaker, Bruis, Ritual, Siri Nova, and Royal Decree. Siri Nova, of course, being the finisher. And Caretaker and Bruis... Caretaker is kind of more of a meta decision because it does take things out of the graveyard, like Skirmishers, or maybe hamper what Skellige is able to do as well. Royal Decree, of course, is consistency for your golds. This particular list that I've popularized a little bit, and Petrify has been also popularizing, does run really interesting cards like Goliath, which doesn't take a lot of damage all that much. and stuff like She-Troll, which can be 17 points with a Rot Fiend on if there's four things to hit. It can be 15 points with a Dao on an empty board. It also puts cards in the graveyard for Slizzard. Lots of synergy pretty much all throughout this deck. Shadow, of course, pulls out your Arcuspore. Bruis tends to bring back Arcuspore or Dao. And then your Cyclops and your Barbagazi and your Griffins trigger Death Wish. You get value multiple times. You can go Griffin, Griffin, Barbagazi. You can trigger the Dao three times, stuff like that. Of course, Foglets are there because you're running maybe Aeromancer, maybe Woodland Spirit could be in this deck as well. Dagon gets a Foglet out as well. Slizzard is very capable of getting a card out because of how easy it is to put stuff in the graveyard with stuff like She-Troll or Cyclops or Barbagazi. But you can see basically there's two Cyclops, two Griffin, two Rot Fiend, two Arcuspore, two Dao, two Barbagazi, two Foglets, and two Slizzards. And the Silvers, which I'm doing out of order here, Frightener, Goliath, Alghoul, Aeromancer, Shadow, and She-Troll. So that's the list that I'm running, and I think that there's some variations in there that can be run, but I personally like this list the way it is. And I got the Monsters border because I went something like I got 23 wins in the day that I didn't think I was going to get that border because I was my computer was sick on the weekend, and you know, I had barely any time to do it, but this deck got me to 4K. I don't say easily often, but it easily got me 4K, and I've played it a little bit above 4K as well. It's a good deck. It's very, very good. Probably the best that Deathwish has ever been.
The bronze package is essentially that's the core to it that can't really change much. You have your I keep it's gonna slip out the Larrys and the Davids, the Arcuspores and the Dows,
yeah,
as well as the Barbagazi, the Griffins, the Georgia, the Cyclopses, holy crap, the Cyclopses, the Slizzards, and you know, you go down that list and they're all there, and that package is a really core and very synergistic package. I think that the silver set in this is probably the most interchangeable or techable out of many monster decks that are out there right now. I think certain ones like, I'd say that most likely the Monster's Nest is going to stick in there. The Frightener is going to stay there. She-Troll to me is a good spot, but I don't even think that, Shadow. I mean, I don't play, my first variations didn't play with Rot Fiends, so I found that Shadow was a little bit overreaching for your Death Wish units, but Shadow is not a necessary evil. I play my version without Shadow, and I never seem to have any issues in terms of tempo or grabbing Dows because of something like She-Troll, which can then throw it in the graveyard, and then you can bring it back with Slizzard, or bring one back with Slizzard and whatnot, so you have options even without it, but the gold package is fairly similar, but to me, I mean, that core group of bronzes allows for so much potential power that your silvers you can tech and sort of, you know, tinker with to counter whatever the meta is, be it an Alghoul to beat you know, to eat some graveyard out of a Skellige deck, to, you know, to anything, frankly.
Yeah, like Alghoul is a meta thing. Alghoul and Caretaker are meta decisions, I think, because there's lots of great stuff to eat out of your opponent's graveyard, for sure. Shadow I use early for Arcuspore, personally, because I think that getting both Arcuspores out is important for maybe if you have to, if you have a really good, like, I tend to bleed with Siri Nova decks. I try to get as many cards out of my opponent's hand as possible and then take it with, you know, really strong plays at the end or just Siri Nova. And Goliath tends to be kind of how I like to close things out, so playing Barbagazi for carryover and blocking open passes or creating situations where my opponent has to play into Barbagazi on the board isn't as important to me. And sometimes I'll go for the long round and I'll Bruis Ritual the two Arcuspores out on any round I can. And it makes kind of, it's just kind of a pain, especially when you can have weather ticking at the same time. I do like engine decks. I've always liked engine decks. Radovid, I usually like running Reinforced Trebuchets and Aspirants. And, that's usually kind of, so this really speaks to me as well. And I've of course loved Arid and Moonlight Frost, you know, building as many engines as you possibly can to out tempo the tempo decks. Currently the tempo decks in Gwent are just, they can do more and they can do it faster and they can just outpace you and leave you in the dust. But this deck doesn't feel like that because it has engines, but it also has massive plays in stuff like Griffin and Dao, which is an easy 17 points. All you need to do is afford yourself the time to play the Dao, which is a 6-point bronze. Maybe you can play it with the Shadow as well. In some situations, you can bring back, like, you can have Griffins in your hand for round three, bring back a Dao with Bruis, and then you can start spamming those those lesser Dao as well. I think the Dao is maybe just a sleeper card for me. That's one of my favorite cards right now. Griffin and Dao is such a strong combo and so easy to execute, and Slizzard makes so many things possible. Just got to be careful with the Slizzard. You don't want to eat something that Brewis can res later, but generally you don't. For me, I don't Slizzard Arcospores out. I Slizzard stuff like Dao or Rot Fiend or Griffin or whatever I can. But it took me a while to make sure that I wasn't having a dead Slizzard. And ultimately, Foglet may not be, you could probably tech it out. You could tech out Foglet, perhaps, because Aeromancer is kind of an awkward way to get Foglet out. And if you don't get Aeromancer, you risk mulliganing into it. And I think that that's probably the only clunky, stiff part of the deck. But otherwise, the deck is so smooth. This deck is so smooth. And it's a refreshing look when Consume Monsters is being looked at like it's the apex predator of sometimes of like dwarves and some other things, in that it's so binary and so hard to stop. Where Aridin is okay. Aridin's pretty good with Nova, Ask Ocean Mud. He'll still play it and he'll still get Grandmaster with it. But this is just a nice touch. Dagon coming back, looking pretty good with this deck. I'm a huge fan of it.
What I don't like is that the fact that Dagon is automatically associated with this, and that's why the Foglets are kind of automatically toss-ins because of Dagon being in there. I just find that, you know, it's missing another leader, and I would never play a Whispering Hillock on there because of the fact that there's there's not enough reliability from what you're getting that, you know, that you can sort of be proactive with a leader rather than reactive. Now just imagine if those Earth Elementals still had their shields on them, that would be another thing.
Oh man.
And last point on Death Wish is that it forces a non-seasoned player or a non-super experienced player to play counterintuitively. One way, and I'm giving the secrets out now, but one way to beat a Death Wish deck is obviously to kill those Death Wish units as soon as possible. Even though they provide extra value off the board, you're like a Dao sitting there. You'd think that I'm just going to let it sit there and not let them, you know, touch it. But something that's just sitting there, you know, why am I going to waste damage on a unit that's just going to spawn more points? But it's one way to do it, you know, wasting your Mandrake on a Dao or your Artifact Compression on a Dao, that can sometimes derail the whole thing, but it seems like a counterintuitive, like a really an unnatural play to make. And that's why I like the deck, because it can really take advantage of players that have not seen a wide variety of opponents.
I agree with this because I won a couple of games. I would say I stole a couple of games from people where, and they would come into my chat later and say, I just didn't really think about playing around Rot Fiend, even though, you know, it's just like a card that people don't see very often, or any card like that. That's just like, well, didn't really realize the potential of Dao. I didn't realize that Griffin would get you that many points. I just, you know, it's that surprise factor that Gwent's always been good at, sort of like the way you can approach surprising your opponents with stuff that maybe they're not familiar with, and just kind of shocking them. And there's not a lot left in that, really, for those of us who've been playing for a very long time. But because this deck kind of came out of nowhere for me until I saw it posted, again, by Petrify, who had augmented a Trance Energy 2 list. Perhaps its original origins are more convoluted than that. And perhaps other people have other lists like this that really worked, maybe a different selection of silvers. This one, for me, was great, which is why I wanted to highlight it and talk about it, because I didn't have a lot to talk about for strategy. We've been talking about dwarves like every podcast in some way or form. So this deck also, I have a pretty good win rate against dwarves with this list as well. Generally though, you do need to go second. It does help a lot. But you can outpace them in a lot of situations if you have the right hand for it. I think with the right hand, it's really strong. And I strongly suggest you guys try it out. Try something new. Maybe Deathwish Dagon or Deathwish Monsters in general can be kind of your new thing. And nothing is really changing for this list in the patch except for Siri Nova being nerfed. I don't think anything else has its value changed, so this deck will remain intact. And it's just like, it comes highly recommended by me. And that's all I got to say about it. And of course, Flake, you also champion Deathwish all the time.
Beating that drum for millennia, it seems. Glad that it's in a good space, though, honestly. I'm really glad, and I'm really waiting for that Death Wish leader that's bound to show up at some point, for sure, 100%, maybe not.
Yeah, Dagon could just be warming the bench right there.
Oh, lovely.
Also, Death Deal in the chat also saying that Cyclops throws people off as well. It's true, because not only like anything that triggers the Death Wish in some way, you get so much extra value from it. Plus, you have control options with Cyclops. There's just so much synergy in the deck.
I just want to say one of the most satisfying plays that that you can ever make is killing an Impera Enforcer by chucking a David right at it with a Cyclops. It is the most satisfying and just perfect fit play. I love it.
Or picking up Dagon himself and throwing it at an
sometimes,
enforcer.
Sometimes yeah. If there's a Mangonel that you see that is just waiting for it, it is a yeah. necessary evil to chuck a leader at a machine.
This is Gwent, man. This is the world no, and of course, again, one more time, David is the Dao, Larry is the Arcospore. It's flake terminology.
Naturally, of course.
We're going to talk to the chat, and I'm going to review some tweets about people's experience with the PTR. We're just going to do a little community section right here, and we're going to wrap up the podcast following that. And it seems like people really like the PTR, so let's talk about that afterwards. All right, I'm going to read a couple of tweets here because I did ask the Twitter sphere how they felt about the PTR and basically being involved in a PTR that, because this is for the public the first time that they've had an extended look at this kind of thing. So we're going to be talking about that. But first, I did want to say that the podcast is supported by our Commandos.
Commando!
Our patrons at patreon.com/CommandosHorn. Thanks again for supporting the podcast. I'm going to read this first tweet here. The first tweet here from Blinky00849. I enjoyed it a lot. However, I have a problem with people playing decks such as Mill and Veterans and decks that are going to be nerfed. All they are looking to do is get cheap wins with cards that are going to change instead of testing everything else that needs looking at. This is tough. You can really take a lot from this tweet here. Stuff that needs looking at. It's interesting because I would say that it's good that people were playing Veteran because it gives more data to CD Projekt Red on how strong it is and where the problems lie. So I think it's okay that people were playing Veteran. Mill, I don't know about that, but I think that they've already kind of made a decision on Mill with Avalok. But what do you think about people finding out what's super strong and playing it on PTR? Do you think? I think that that's kind of part of the whole process, personally.
Oh, I'd rather they play it on PTR than, you know, commit an entire season to having to be stuck with that meta, right? Or that particular overpoweredness. The PTR is there to weed out those things before they become giant long-term issues. So the fact that I was running into veteran after veteran after veteran for a couple days in a row, if anything, you know, if you want to look at it from a positive and optimistic standpoint, it gets you a little bit more experience from it so that when the changes do come and they might be just tweaked down a little bit, at least you'll have the fundamentals of how to actually play against it. So the fact that things or people were playing overpowered decks in there, that's what they're there for. If they are looking at just the amount of play rates of certain factions in PTR, well, that itself is an indicator of what needs to be looked at, right?
Yeah, for sure. I agree with that. Albert writes, more card text is needed. Example, spies not saying what the counter is for us. So one of the big changes on the PTR is that spies can only trigger once. You can't decoy a spy. You can't Emir pick up and drop a spy. You can't summoning circle spy either. There is one spy and one spy only for your deck. And if the thing is, it still kind of creates a problem where if you don't have a counter spy and you are in the red coin, it is still going to be very strong. So we are somehow being okay with this being the level of spyitude. But generally, more description needed for so people can understand what's going on with spies. I do think that tooltips, while they were kind of cut down and made more concise, a lot of important information for the players was left off. So hopefully this is something that's going to be addressed.
I would like to see that. I mean, from a spy perspective for card advantage, I think that the entire concept of spies being on the other side of the board needs to be addressed. I think that instant card advantage option should probably be removed for something more along cards like Ockfist or Ciri. Mm-hmm. I think that card advantage should be something that is given a chance to be looked up or given it, your opponent has a chance to actually respond to it. Whereas Ciri, you know, it could be you can just pass immediately and that's fine, and they have to decide, they have the option to respond to it. Something like Okvist, you have four turns, and it's not just the card advantage, it's the card advantage plus the damage and et cetera, et cetera. So I think that card advantage should be something less instantaneous and less, if you don't have it, you're screwed kind of thing like that, because it becomes a race to win round one and then having that spy. So, you know, something along the lines of reworking the spy entirely and removing it in favor of other types of or cards, like, you know what, put the spy on your own side and give it a counter where, like, a counter of three or four, you know, where your opponent may have an option of just passing on you and not getting that card advantage, but maybe you have the round, so to speak. I don't know. I don't have all the answers, but the fact that that instant gratification of tossing a spy and sort of wiping your hands clean, especially with the amount of, because 20 points is not safe to sort of hero pass on someone with one card. 24 points is not necessarily safe. So having spy on a round that you can toss away is just kind of a death sentence, right? So that whole thing needs to be looked at, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's always going to be an issue as long as having a card over your opponent is as powerful as it currently is. It's always going to be a thing. The Shoe Plays, host of Grandmaster Plan, tweeted at me saying the PTR was a very good thing and was very healthy for the game. This way we only have 5 days of oppressive veterans instead of a month. And this is what kind of sunk the midwinter update. So the idea that stuff wasn't really tested or there wasn't enough time to pivot on stuff that was identified as being too strong, and the stuff that stuck around for a very, very long time, such as the state of dwarves right now. So this could have been a rough meta where we had to deal with veterans and 13 point beastmasters, which sounds so much worse than the way dwarves currently are, and that's saying something. So I think that catching stuff like this, if this stuff maybe was not caught, I think that maybe the change of veterans was maybe just to show us why they made the change, but maybe that's just me being optimistic.
No, you're right. I mean, let's just put it this way. Any form of universe or any sort of dimension that I get thrown into where I have to deal with Skellige being like hyper-powered for an entire month might actually just like collapse the world until, yeah, you know, I jump into a black hole and with my like face first, mouth open, with a smile on my face kind of thing. Like that would be the end of it for me. So PTR good, just for getting rid of that potential dimension.
Yeah. I mean, the restore nerf also is probably makes you pretty happy as well. It makes me really happy to know that Sigurd Reef is not going to be bringing back 8 strength, Beastmasters. So yeah, for sure. Also in the chat, we'll talk to some chat questions. This is another Death Wish question for you. Do you think Yennefer Conjurer and Triss Butterfly Spell need Revenge Death Wish back? And if you maybe are forgetting on the podcast, Triss Butterfly Spell and Yennefer Conjurer, also known as YenCon, their effects, which is Triss boosts lowest units on the board, Yennefer damages the highest units on your opponent's side of the board. They had an effect where their abilities would proc once or in some cases twice when they were removed, which made them higher value and a risk to remove. Not really a risk to remove. You'd still get more value removing them, but it made it so you'd at least get more value out of it. Those things were removed. Do you think that they could get those back perhaps? Because with Elzer's Thunder being 9, Yennefer Conjurer is just waiting to get zapped basically.
It would be nice if they got him back. It would probably give him a little bit more value, but I mean, I tried playing I made a meme deck. It was just pretty much all weather and Larry's and YenCon, and it was just sort of as much attrition value as I can get on the board to sort of just frustrate your opponent into a pass. Mm-hmm. I liked YenCon at 10. I think that she definitely saw some value down the road. In rounds where she was untouched for, you know, five turns, she easily turned into, you know, an 18 to 20 point gold, just by crushing units down. And, she has her shortcomings obviously. And so giving that extra little boost would be good. I think obviously it would, any type of buff you see give to a gold that's not seeing all that much play obviously is going to be a good thing. And I think that especially from Butterfly, she'll get an extra one or two ticks off of your board, of your swarm board. So that could definitely see a lot of value just out of removing her.
Yeah, that question came from Patrick Wood 94, by the way. And I think that at least with Butterfly activating on turn end, you're more likely to get value out of her. But Yennefer Conjure used to be the strongest gold in the game, if not one of the, I think one of the strongest golds, if not the strongest gold in the game. It was tyrannical how good that card was when golds were immune. So pretty crazy stuff.
And she came out at like 4 or 5 points too. Yeah. She wasn't even the 10 spot that she was now.
Yeah, but I mean, the game was totally different as far as
100%. Like, yeah, definitely. Seeing her on turn one was an instant, just like, forget this. Like, yeah. not even happening.
Yeah. How do you feel? Mr. Creeper Phil wants to know how we feel about Skellige card names returning.
Card names
in general, I guess, because it's not just Skellige that gets names. Like, a lot of the names are changed.
I think that's a good thing, obviously, because you're obviously taking this game from the lore of The Witcher and kind of simplifying from it. It just seems like you're trying to step away from what the game is supposed to be about and the characters that made it as rich as it is, because sometimes it's nice to see. And I started reading the books, actually. I delved into it for about a month ago. I'm almost done The Last Wish, which is cool. And seeing some of the names that you see in the game is really exciting for me to sort of make those connections. And I mean, seeing from the question that was asked about Skellige names, now it's just harder for me to curse them out whenever I see them, but that's fine. It's not a big deal. But it's, I think, from the standpoint of the game being, there you go, there's The Last Wish, yeah. So seeing this is the game from the standpoint of the characters and the names and the lore and the history, you know, I think that's a fantastic thing. I would never want to see a card game, let's say a Star Wars card game, where, you know, Emperor Palpatine was called, like, Palpy. Like, I would just be like, screw that. Like, you know, like, it would just be
the Emperor, probably. I mean,
yeah, or so, or yeah, you know, like Palpy. Big E or something like that. Like, nah, not happening. Not interested.
Yeah. Let's do one more question here. Let's see. This is an interesting kind of thought exercise here. I don't think, let's take this lightly, but Nmetz 0678 is saying, what do you think about two players playing one card at the same time as an answer to coin flip? Personally, I don't think that answers the coin flip because one player would eventually go first in that situation. But I'm also like envisioning a situation where you play cards at the exact same time. You can only interact with the stuff that's on the board. Meanwhile, your opponent is also doing that at the same time. I mean, there's so much to say about how weird that would be, and it obviously changes the game fundamentally, but I don't think it fixes the coin flip because I think that ultimately it's about who goes last, not so much about who goes first.
Right. I think that it's an interesting concept. There was a game. So the card game Lord of the Rings, which is now defunct, it was an old Decipher game, but it was a very, very, very well-made game. And they resolved the who goes first option by you essentially bid. And the bidding that was done was there's a concept, a part of the game that were called burdens. And your main character, Frodo, if he accumulated an X amount of burdens, he would be corrupt and you'd lose the game. Hmm. So you'd bid burdens, and that amount of burdens gave you kind of like a disadvantage. If you want to go first, which was an obvious, in that game was a hyper advantage. If you want to go first, you have to outbid your opponent. So you'd have to really put yourself at a disadvantage and behind the eight ball in terms of winning and losing the game. Now, one of the ideas that I thought would be interesting to resolve this was you get your starting hand of, let's say you drew 11 instead of 10 cards, and then you bid a card. And the strength value of that card would then determine who gets to choose who goes first or second. But that card then becomes discarded or banished. And so you're at a disadvantage in that side. And I mean, obviously people would probably toss in throwaway cards or whatnot. And it's not a perfect solution, but I think that maybe a perspective of bidding with a card and then having it banished from your deck could be an interesting point. But then people would just honestly play 26 card decks and put, you know, an Imperial Manticore or something huge in it just to toss away. But then you have to rely on drawing it. Then people, they RNG, and there's no simple solution. Easily said than done.
Yeah, it's really tough. I mean, I don't envy CDPR for this solution that they may ultimately have to come up with something that makes it just a little bit less advantageous to go second. And it's tough. I mean, we see in the tournament landscape, it's not as big of an issue, but in the ladder landscape, when you can streak, it is absolutely an issue. And it's, you are playing from a position of disadvantage. And I think that I mean, my creative idea is that you, if you go first, you get points when your opponent passes, but not until then, and you wouldn't get points when you pass. But I can't test that. I don't know if that's good. That could be a terrible idea. But it's just an idea. And I think that everybody's got ideas. There's lots of potential proposed ideas, but none of these ideas really can get tested in a space that could yield the data that would actually show a change in win rate. Something needs to be implemented. Something needs to be tested. So it's possible, even if it doesn't work, I think it would be a great gesture if there is maybe some sort of iteration of a coin flip fix pushed out to a future PTR. I know that we would love to try it, even if it didn't work, even if it was just because I think everybody can agree, based on the amount of time it has taken and the amount of debates that have been going on, that this is a difficult problem to fix. I think that we can maybe have mercy on that, if whatever they come up with, maybe if it didn't work right away, we would still be happy to test it and happy to see something at all. So one day soon, hopefully we're testing a solution. And with each test, we come closer and closer to a solution that makes the community happy. It makes the competitive scene happy. And that's what I'd like to see. I think that in the state that it is right now, I mean, we all play the game. We all know how it feels to get blue coin games over and like 3, 4, 5 games in a row. So for sure.
Let's just be glad that Squirtle does not have their old passive ability in this current meta. That would be a nightmare.
Yeah, absolutely. But that said, I think that's good for questions from the chat and questions from Twitter. We can wrap it up here. Flake, you have done me a solid. Some guests fell through, and we do have the rotating co-host chair. So Flake, you are sitting in that chair. And you are a streamer, of course, host of CoinFlip, and going to be host of the Wild Hunt Philly tournament. Some people were asking, maybe they don't know who you are, where you are from, and what you're up to. Let people know where people can find you when you're doing your thing.
Yeah, absolutely. So I am available to view at your own leisure, but I guess that would be on a schedule, being Monday to Friday, Monday to Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. I do stream on Twitch, mostly Deathwish. So all the talking I've been doing about Deathwish, I try to back it up with actual gameplay. Other than that, you can find me on, now becoming a little bit more popular, and I'm actually very happy about this because a lot of people are having fun. Fridays at 8 o'clock Eastern Standard Time is the Bev stream, where we get a little bit more adult-oriented in terms of our beverage consumption, always doing so responsibly, obviously. But that said, it's always a fun time. A lot of great people hang out at that time. And you can catch me there. I will, in fact, be the host of the Wild Hunt North American Tournament. I'm very excited about that because we're going to have fantastic casters like McBee, and Joe Snow is going to be there as well, casting those tournaments. So check that out as well. And if you haven't already, because I'm just going to go down the entire plug list, the Coin Flip, if you want to go take a look at my YouTube channel, or Top Deck's YouTube channel, they have my video up there. It's for the Coin Flip. It's a Gwent debate show that features Gwent streamers talking about important topics. The only part about that is that they're not always entitled to their own unique opinions. They have to sort of either take one side of the coin or the other. So sometimes they're really pushed into a corner and have to say things like, I love Mill, and they're not happy about it. Nonetheless, that's where you can find me.
Great, yeah, great content with CoinFlip as well. And good production value as well. A lot of good stuff in there. I am a fan as well, and hopefully we can do an episode when I'm not. You asked me to do one, and I was so sick that weekend.
You turned on
Skype, and it's like, no, you can't do this.
But to be fair, in your defense, you did say, no, I can do this, I can do this. And literally, it would hurt my feelings if that I was the cause of your own demise. So no, we were not going to make that happen.
Well, it was good to you spared my life. So someday in the future. For me personally, you can find me at McBeardCH on Twitter. I tweet all sorts of stuff about the podcast and about Gwent in general. You can find me there. And also I post my Twitch schedule on Twitter as well. And you can also find me on Twitch at McBearded. We try to stream every weekday or at least 5 days a week. And finally, McBeard on YouTube, where you can find this podcast as well as other videos I put together. Deck guides, stream highlights, lots of fun stuff. And finally, when it comes to the podcast, you can find the podcast on Twitter at Commander's Horn. And you can email us at commandershornpodcast@gmail.com. Always looking forward to hearing your comments, questions, discussion topics, and perhaps you want to you're looking for a specific guest. We can maybe make that work. Let us know who you want to see on the show in the future. But that'll do it. Flake, thanks so much for joining me, and thanks to everybody in the chat for joining as well. It was great to have you, and hopefully, you know, we're going to keep doing this live. We're going to keep things going strong for Commander's Horn. Lots of stuff on the horizon. But that'll be it for us. Until next time, this is McBeard for Flake. Best of luck on the path.